Welcome once again to the Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, consumer advocate, with another monthly edition of The Edge. Jay, I have to ask you if you ever have a hard time following your own advice. You have a hard time staying up, staying on the edge?
I don't have a hard time staying on the edge, but with his mind as fertile and prolific as mine, I sometimes get overwhelmed, and I sometimes think the sky is falling, and I sometimes have to wrestle that demon monster procrastination and ambivalence. And I think it probably is at a higher level than people who might be listening to this, but I don't think it's any different.
Talk about that just a little bit. Explain what goes on, or what you would assume other people experience.
Well, I think that sometimes in life you have so many options that it's hard to be pragmatic. I think that if you're dealing with breakthrough concepts, as simple and as logical as they may sound, they're so intangible that it's hard for certain people to be able to get their hand around. It's almost amorphous, and it makes it more intimidating. And I think the smartest thing to do is, first and foremost, break things down. There's a great story of one of the greatest industrialists of all time, Charles Schwab. Not Charles Schwab, the stock person, but Charles Schwab, I think his great-great-grandfather. He was the president of U.S. Steel, and he was the protege of Andrew Carnegie.
All right.
And he was introduced back in the 20s to a famous, famous management guru called Ivy Lee, I-V-Y-L-E-E. Ivy Lee was probably the most renowned management and time management expert in the whole era. And he had a 30-minute meeting with Ivy Lee, and he was lamenting, I got all these things I want to do, and I can't get half the things done, and I'm frustrated, and the day goes by, and I feel like I haven't accomplished a lot. And Ivy Lee gave him a technique which I have actually followed, and it's so simple it's embarrassing, but I think that elegant solutions are the secret to making life much more productive, much more fulfilling, much more profitable in all gradients. And Ivy Lee taught him the simple formula, and he said, all you have to do, first of all, is list everything you've got to do, and then value rank them on the basis of what absolutely is the most critical thing. If you only got one thing done today, what would it have to be and why? If you only got two things done today, what would the two have to be and why in order? If you only got a third thing done, what would it be? And he went through it and he said, value rank what absolutely, if nothing else happened, what you have to do today. And make that list, and then he said, do nothing more but follow the list. Don't let anything divert you. Don't get on tangential calls. Just do basically what you have to do. Get the first thing done first. If you say, if nothing else, I've got to have this done, do it. He said, you will be amazed how much you'll get done, how significant the effort you expend will be in result and in action, how much relief you've given yourself as far as anxiety, frustration, sense of knowing that you are far behind and procrastinating, and how little you'll be inclined to procrastinate. And he said, don't pay me anything. Try it for a month and then send me a check for whatever you think it's worth. This is back in the 20s. A month later, Charles Schwab sent Ivy Lee a check for $25,000, which by today's standards would be like paying you, I don't know, $300,000-$400,000 for the idea. And he wrote him a note, and I'm paraphrasing it, that this is singularly, I've gotten so much more accomplished in so much less time by following the seemingly simple process. And I use it too. If you don't basically have, I mean, it's probably much more sophisticated, you can use your computer, but if you don't have a yellow pad, and you don't list on that yellow pad everything that's going on in your life, and then you don't rank them on real importance, and then you don't basically do the first things first, and the second things second, and the third things third, and you don't avoid doing the maybe more intimidating things, but you embrace them with full sense of adventure and passion, then you're probably going to be less than optimally in your effectiveness and what you accomplish and in your mental clarity, because you're going to be cluttered. You're going to be intimidated. If you don't have clarity of thought, you're never going to have clarity of action. You're going to be less than you could. You're going to accomplish a lesser amount. You're going to sub-optimize all of your actions. And I'll give you a little treatise that I did one time on procrastination, because it might be pretty interesting, and I think it might be real fun if you'll indulge me, because I've had in my life a history of being a procrastinator. I've been an inveterate procrastinator over time, and the only way I can overcome and control my procrastination is through the strict regimen I just suggested. I follow it religiously. Perhaps it'll help some of the people if they listen to a few of my notes. First thing every morning, review a list of all the people you have to contact, all the letters you have to write, all the transactions you have to facilitate, all the decisions you have to make. Figure out what you have to do by yourself and what you can delegate to someone else. then prioritize the list into three categories. What I'll call imperative status, the things you absolutely have to do yourself, and rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, and things that absolutely are more important than anything else and have to be done first. The things you can delegate, then rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the things that are non-time sensitive that can be, I don't want to use the word deferred, but aren't going to be critical to getting your business going and your life moving and the status quo being maintained. Then scan your calendar and allocate your workload so it balances your day. Try to attack the hardest but most important functions first, not last, and get them off your agenda. That makes it easy to address time-critical functions. I don't think we talked about this, but I do a lot of things that are, for me, a little bit intimidating and challenging. We do this program with a regular scheduled basis. I do a radio show. I write a lot of different complex programming pieces, ads, letters, reports for a lot of different complex clients, and I try to embrace each one with a sense of discovery and commitment and get those over first and do the easier things later, because there's so much of a relief. You remove and jettison so much of the intimidation that psychologically burdens us, Marty. Accomplishment early in the day fuels your desire to achieve more. It'll fuel an incredible sense of how much more capacity you have when you do that. I try to accomplish as many things as I can before noon. Most of my phone calls are made early in the morning. After lunch, I write letters and hold meetings because I want to get as much in motion, as much velocity in motion. In addition to my regular work schedule, I have a number of projects that are constantly what I'll call in process. They're what I call advancement transactions, and they tend to represent the biggest abstract impediment for a procrastinator like me or like the people listening, because for the most part, they are glints of inspiration or ambition. They're very conceptual. You conceive them in your mind, and now you must bring them to life and imbue them with dimension, and it's a real challenge. If they require any interaction by at least one outsider, what I found is I need to keep advancing the development and completion effort on the project, so I use a number of tricks to stay on track. I envision my ultimate result. For example, I want to create a profit center, let's say operating with X people and bringing in Y amount of dollars each month. I dissect that vision into its smallest base component, and I work on that component first. Usually the base problem to overcome is to get the structure established. I reduce everything I do for myself as well as my clients to a series of little, logical, progressive, baby-sized steps. Remember we talked on one of the programs, Marty, about the way to eat an elephant. It's one step at a time. And you don't try to eat it from the top. You probably start from the bottom up. I keep advancing forward, always in a progressive, sequentially logical order.
Let me interrupt. Even at your level of competence, you still break things down into small, small units.
I have to because I'll tell you what. If you don't have you have to have the clearest, definitive picture broken down to its component parts of what you're trying to accomplish, or you really never can accomplish anything effectively, because it's too abstract, it's too uncertain, it's not really concrete in your mind if you don't break it down to its steps. I think the greatest model you can ever use is, if you ever get frustrated until you're overwhelmed, think of how an architect or a builder or a developer or a contractor works. They start with a foundation. I mean, they start with just a raw piece of land. If not, they start with something on it, they knock it down, or they gut it. Then they put a solid foundation, and the foundation is the key element. Then they build the skeletal structure. Then around the skeletal structure, they put skin, or they frame it. Then they basically do all the finish work, and it's a progression, and it's nothing different than how you should create your business life. They don't start at the top. They start at the bottom first, and they build up. We try to make life so much more complex, protracted, abstract, and intimidating than life needs or wants to be made. Life is there to basically be so simple and open to us if we'll but embrace it logically.
All right. How about just real briefly talk about someone you greatly admire? You mentioned Lasker. Tell us just real briefly about your admiration.
Well, my whole success is a byproduct of me studying great people and trying to learn from them, interact with them, model them, dialogue with them if they're alive, and study them extensively. Two or three people that I really have been influenced by are Claude Hopkins, the father of scientific advertising and marketing, and Albert Lasker, the father of salesmanship in print. I mention both of them because their careers intertwined. Albert Lasker was to advertising, to positioning, to direct response advertising what Thomas Edison was to the light bulb. He lived in the 20s and 30s and 40s. He went to work for it, but he really recreated and reconstructed what became the most formidable and preeminent advertising agency in the country. It was called Lord and Thomas. It was based in Chicago and was a forerunner of Foote, Cone, and Belding. Lasker got started at an era when people had no idea what made advertising work. People would run basically ads that were like what they call tombstone ads, the kind of things financial institutions run. They didn't say much. They were just declaratory. They didn't pull well. Occasionally somebody would pull well, but he wouldn't know why. And he started studying it, and he was obsessed with it. He wanted to know why ads, some ads worked, why others didn't. What was advertising? What was good advertising? He studied it. He studied it. He studied it. He found, to his great, great, great delight, he and another man named John Kennedy collaboratively conjured up the awareness that all advertising is salesmanship in print or salesmanship over the airwaves. And when they realized that all it was taking one-on-one selling and embodying the key components into the format you're using, whether it be a print ad, a direct mail letter, electronic advertising, they made incredible breakthroughs, and they had mounted massive reconstruction campaigns for the likes of Quaker Oats, Palmolive, many of the General Motors lines, and they escalated companies from number 10 or 11 to number 1 in 6 months, 9 months. They made massive, massive millionaires and multimillionaires back before billions of dollars was even contemplatable. And he did it by understanding that all advertising is a salesmanship in print. And when they understood that, then they just studied what selling is, and they were able to very easily and quickly and powerfully embody all the elements that made selling work into the advertising. And it was basically, it's pretty much similar to this AIDA formula. You get attention, you get people's interest. Attention, interest, desire. You get them to desire the product or service or result the product or service produces for yourself, and then basically you get them to take action. And when they realize that's the same formula that you use to compel people to buy from you one-on-one when you are selling or persuading them, it was a profound revelation of connectivity. And Claude Hopkins, the man that I think more influenced me than anybody else, was the key idea man and the key strategist and the key copywriter for Albert Lasker for about three-quarters of his key heyday years in the advertising business. And Claude Hopkins was the man who developed and perfected and identified more advertising stratagems, philosophies, and laws for direct response and for basically making ads pay off better than anything else that you had available to you, and making sure that if an ad worked, he didn't sit on his laurels. He always found a better approach, a better headline, a better offer, a better pricing, a better positioning that worked even more. And he was a great, he was the forerunner and the creator of the preemptive ad. And the preemptive ad is nothing more, or the preemptive position is nothing more than the ability to articulate the key ingredients behind either the production, the construction, the creation, the rendering, the training of the people who render, acquiring of the products or the processes or the components that make the product, and articulating and explaining that to the public in a way that seems to give predominance or preemptive distinction to you, even if it's the same way everybody operates their business or creates their product, because no one else has ever talked about it. I think in some of the material we sent it might be explained, but I tell this really simple story that Claude Hopkins did for Albert Lasker in the 20s for Schlitz Beer right after Prohibition. It was a pretty interesting story.
We talked about that at another tape. What you're talking about leads me to ask you to talk about one of your key strategies, and that is don't use ineffective advertising. I realize that everyone listening to this tape may not use advertising, but there are other applications. Talk about not using ineffective advertising.
Sure. Most people don't have the slightest understanding of what advertising's intent is, and if they can possibly make it past that limitation, they have no idea how to marshal the fullest force and the potency and the profitability of an ad, and they don't understand that advertising should be looked at as a profit center, not an expense. First of all, advertising is salesmanship in print. As such, it's got to basically adhere and uphold the same tenets that a good selling presentation or proposition does. By that, it needs to have an incredible, attention-getting headline that produces for you the conveyance of a great self-serving result to the reader. In other words, you've got to be able to transfer and translate and broadcast to the reader a powerful and a self-serving result that he or she can be desired of getting and can be assured of getting if they A, read the rest of the ad, and B, take action on it. So it's got to have a great headline. The headline is 80 to 90% of the effectiveness of the ad. If you don't have a great headline, you're really compromising 75% to 90% of the whole potential of the ad. Presuming you have a great headline, I think on one of our other programs we started a series of discussing what headlines should be, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
So there is one of these programs that talks about headlines, but you got to have a great headline. Headline's got to offer and denominate a great result. The more specifically, the more comparably, the more measurably, and the more definitively you can make that result claim or promise, the more powerful the ad. Once you make the claim, you've gotten their attention. Now you've got to develop their interest by explaining to them and sharing with them and dimensionalizing the implications and the applications of your product or service or result in a way they can desire and see it being a part of their life or their business. You've got to make it alive by showing them how much richer or easier or more powerful life or their business can be if they incorporate whatever the product or service or result you're offering is. And you've got to show them how real it is by showing them proof. You do that in the body copy. You've got to position your ad to address the highest and most critical area of importance, both logically and emotionally, you can find in the hearts and the souls and the wallets and the logic of your prospect. Once you do that, you've got to build your case. You build your case by providing facts and interpreting them in a way that you're basically, in written form, advocating or championing the positioning of the reader. You don't just give abstract points. You give very detailed facts. Then you tell about why and how those facts make valuable relevancy to their life and how they can use those facts to take fuller advantage of something they're doing or something they're buying or something they use or a part of their life. Then you illustrate how other people have used it, so they've got a reference frame of peers they can relate to who have enjoyed a richer, more productive, more profitable, safer life through the use of your product. Then you make them an offer that is devoid of risk or is as little risk-based as possible. I think in one of our programs we talked a lot about risk reversal, didn't we?
Yes, yes.
Then you've got to direct them to action and tell them what action to take. And depending upon the complexity, the pricing, the usage of your product, you may want them to render an order right there. You may want them to come in. You may want them to send you their name and address. You may want them to pick up the phone. You may want them to send for a sample or a booklet or to call to arrange someone coming to their facility or someone to render a preview or an evaluational analysis or a free consultation. You may want any of a number of different actions, but the key to effective advertising is it's got to first and foremost identify and telegraph the biggest result you can promise specifically to the most highest probability-based prospect. It shouldn't be just entertaining or humorous. It should be telegraphing a message to the intended prospect. Number two, it's got to basically build the case, and it's got to demonstrate application and implication of the product in a result-inducing manner. Keep in mind, whatever you sell, product or service, you don't really sell a product or service. People are buying a result. The more you transfer your focus and your orientation from things to results, the more powerful you'll be communicating. You take them through the whole process, through developing it, dimensionalizing it, illustrating it in action, showing them how it can change their life. If you are able to do it, take them on a journey to the future when they have the product or service and its result applying itself to their lives. Show them how much richer or easier or fuller their life will be. Tell them that they can try it out or they can preview it or they can learn about it or where they can actually use the product free of risk, free of worry for a finite period of time and develop a risk reversal or a better than risk reversal or some degree of risk reversed proposition, and then tell them how and why to take action today. How to do it as far as the transactions, pick up the phone, come in, write this, send it down, call this number, come into this office, wait till the next time we call and respond. Set them up ethically for the transactional result you want, for the follow-through action you want them to take, and then assure them at the end of what an improvement in their life or business will come about by doing that, and then summarize at the end the result one more time. That's pretty much it.
Okay, talk just a little bit about how to find the highest benefit there, number one in your whole step.
Well, I mean, I'm going to create the answer to this question for the first time now because I've never really thought about it. It's very intuitive to me, but if I was teaching someone to do it, I'd say, first of all, identify all the benefits, all the results. Then value rank them on two different criteria. Number one, which ones have the broadest spectrum of universal appeal? In other words, you got to break down and realize that whatever market you're after, there's going to be many different buying imperatives, many different hot buttons, and many different components to any heterogeneous market. And I used to do a mail order class, and I used to talk about subjectivity and objectivity, and I'll give you an example from that, and it'll tie all in. I used to have a room full of 200-300 people wanting to learn about mail order, and I'd yell out the words, big money. And when I said big money, I'd randomly go around the room, Marty, and I'd interview people and say, well, what came to mind? To somebody who was making $10 an hour, big money may have been $25 or $50 an hour. To somebody making $2,000 a month, big money may have been $5,000 or $10,000 a month. To somebody making $5,000 a month, it may have been $250,000. To somebody making $250,000, it may have been $1 million, but maybe $1 million to one person in a lump sum, $1 million a year to another. I then went back and asked people why they were in the mail order session I was doing, and the reasons were equally as varied. Some were there because they wanted to develop a new career. Some were there because they had hobbies they wanted to turn into profitable endeavors. Some were there because they had a chance to move or they wanted to move to a warmer climate but had no negotiable skill and they needed to find a means to support themselves. Some were getting ready to retire and wanted a purposeful way to supplement their reduced income. The point is, if I had presumed that everybody was there because big money meant $5,000 a month and they were all on the precipice of retirement, I would have eliminated appealing to 95% of them. So you got to find what appeals to the highest number first and what produces the biggest payoff to the highest number. Does that make sense, Marty?
All right. It goes back to your philosophy of always test.
Well, it does, and you can do that a lot of different ways. If you're not sure, before you spend a fortune on an ad in a magazine, you can pick up the phone and you can see, a lot of people think they have to be definitive when, in fact, sometimes all you can be is indicative. In other words, if you're thinking, if you had 20 different key points or key hot buttons or key premises and you couldn't really discriminate which ones were the highest and the most impactful, you could try a little test that would be indicative, maybe not definitive, but indicative. You could call 25 or 125 of your past customers or prospects and try different ones of these as hot buttons with 10 here and 5 here and just gauge what the general response was, and that would be indicative. You could send out a couple hundred letters and try 20 of them with one headline based on one premise, one with another, and see which ones evoke the most response. You could talk to people in your facility or on the phone and try different trial balloon propositions embodied around different ones of those premises, and you'll get an indication of which ones will produce more or less response, more or less interest, more or less passion or emotional feedback, and that will be indicative if you can't figure it out, Marty. Does that help?
Yes, that does. A tremendous way to generate insight as well as probably new techniques.
You got to realize one thing. If you are committed to my philosophy and you want to optimize and you want to get the very most you can out of everything and every dollar and every action you take, you don't have the right to do anything based on conjecture. You can't do something just because you like it or you are interested in it. You got to try to figure out what's going to have the greatest resonance in the mind, the heart, and the wallet of the biggest segment of the target audience you want to reach.
Let's move this out of the idea of advertising into the application of sales. It's possible, from what I would gather then, that you could actually generate multiple presentations and maybe come up with some results you never expected.
Well, I mean, there's two or three things you got to remember. Different people are responding to different stimulus. and different people's motivations change. I'll use a great example of something that happened to me years ago. Years ago, I bought a little house by the beach, and I used every dime I had, and the house was in horrendous condition and had to be gutted. I had a very limited budget to gut it with, and I brought in a very important designer because I wanted it to look great, and she was put off because I had such a little budget and could only afford to do one room. She did the room, and I spent about $40,000 on it, and I was broke. And she knew I had five or six more rooms to do, but at that point I had no money and no capacity.
Okay.
But my circumstances changed as a little bit of time went on, and I was able to first and foremost finish all the rooms. Then I was able to redo the whole exterior of the house. Then I was able to add a whole office outside the house. Then I was able to do the whole courtyard over. Then I was able to move to a bigger house that I spent $250,000 on. Then I was able to move to an even bigger house that I spent even more money on. But this person stopped because I didn't respond to the one stimulus that she was programmed to, which was doing the whole total house and having an unlimited budget. So if she had followed through and changed her stature and started being interested in my growth and given me a sequential strategy of action, she would have basically gotten about $500,000 more business from me, and she would have gotten sales because I could have committed right there and then that, yes, I would do more as soon as I could afford it, but I had no money now, so yes, we could have put a program in place that we could have done in installments and in sequences. I could have committed to it right there and then, even though no money would have changed hands, and she could have just kept in touch with me as my circumstances, cash flow, and reserves improved.
Can you talk about that a little more, about how to conceptualize that for ourselves as well as to transmit to those who work for us or around us?
Well, I think you got to look at your relationships with people. Any prospect you are going to embrace, if you have an attitude that it's only a matter of time before they become your customer, and that it's only a matter of time before that customer buys from you again and again, and that they're a customer for life, and you're going to basically serve them very frequently because you know in your heart that the more service you give them, the more they avail themselves of your product or service, and its result, the more successful, the richer, the more productive, the safer their life is going to be, and it's going to be more enhanced, so you owe it to them for that to occur. And your philosophy is that it's only a matter of time, and the matter of time will be shortened by your ability to find better ways to communicate to them the advantages and the results, so they'll be made easier to understand how it will enhance their life at a higher degree, so they'll be more inclined to want to avail themselves of it. That's a good start philosophically.
Now, how do you communicate that to other people around you that might work for you?
Well, I think you let them in on the method of your madness. You don't just give them a directive and tell them, do this. You show them why, and you share with them the respect you have for the customer, and you share with them the fact that your motivation is not for your company to grow, and your motivation is not for your company to get rich. Your motivation is to enrich your customer, and that you show them a different orientation. And you show them how your job has got to be to transfer from your awareness to the customer's awareness and understanding and appreciation of all the different ways your products or services can help protect and expand the quality of your customer's life, and that different people are at different points in the continuum. Different people understand and respond to different stimulus. Different people have different motivation. Different people are at points in their lives where different issues are most compelling to them, and that your job and challenge has got to be to present the case, present the benefit, present the result, present the application of your product or service in as many different ways as you can devise to illustrate the advantages to your customers in many different dimensions, because different people see things conceptually, they see things auditorily, they see things kinesthetically, they see things in different ways. See, most people, Marty, they do it all wrong. They do it ass backwards, excuse my vulgarity, but they say, here's the way I insist on you seeing this issue, and if you're not willing to see it the way I want you to, I'm not going to do business with you. Because they restrict their customers' ability to see things, because all they allow any room for is the one dimension of expression that they are comfortable with. That has nothing to do with what the customer might be comfortable with.
Okay, how about generating a letter here to correct that? Let's say that I've had a going business and I have been doing this backwards. Is there a way I could correct this instantaneously?
Well, I mean, are you talking about a letter to your customer?
Yes.
Greatest strategy I have found for that is what I'll call self-effacing honesty, basically conceding and admitting that maybe you didn't tell them everything that you could have, and maybe you didn't share with them the whole case, and maybe you haven't really taken full opportunity to share with them the way you see the relationship. And maybe if you start with a letter from the owner saying, I'm writing to correct a disservice or an injustice I've unintentionally done you, and in the process hopefully share with you the reason why I am so passionate, and I've been in, I've had a love affair with my product and service for all these years, and with you, and I've never shared it with you, and maybe by helping share it with you, you'll understand more about why I am so excited about what I do and what I think I can do for you. And you start by saying, 20 years ago I started this business, not with a desire to grow rich and be important, but with a desire to make people's lives better, to bring about greater benefit, greater result, greater whatever, and you denominate the specific implications of your product. I was very lucky because of my passion and my connectivity with people and my ability to find other team members who could share that vision and transfer it. We've grown and we've done well, but I think in the process we've almost overlooked sharing more completely and dimensionally with our customers all the different ways and all the different impacts and all the different implications and all the different advantages, all the different meaningful results we're able to help bring to their lives in the different ways we can do it, so you can better appreciate the advantage our product or service renders you, and then go through a litany of all the different ways and all the different possibilities and all the ways you might use it and how you might look at it and the ways you might justify it and the different changes and beneficial improvements in your life that are brought about when you use it, and then admit and say, you know, I always assumed everyone was just interested in this application. I realize that I'm interested most in that, but you may see a whole different benefit. You may look at life from a whole different set of glasses. You may have a whole different take on the issue, and I owe it to you to help you see the benefit and the value of applying or using or incorporating my product or service into your life from your point of view, not mine. And then as part of the admission, you want to make up to them the disservice you've done by not making it easier for them to see the fullest benefit, so you make them an offer that's preferential, either preferential on pricing, it can be preferential on how much more of the product or complementary products or services you put together with the product. It can be taking away the risk by giving them a chance to try a larger unit or a more expansive unit or an extension of the basic product or service or a different product or service for a finite period of time free of risk. But some reward you give them as payment for the fact that you didn't really do them the fullest service you can, and then you tell them what to do to take full advantage of it.
Okay.
Does that work?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
You made a promise on a previous tape that you would talk about the business profile questions that you use with your clients. And I have to ask you, why are you willing to share this? I mean, technically what you're about to share is worth tons and tons and tons of money.
We've actually sold the profile that I'm going to talk about for as much as $1,000 to people, and we've licensed it for a lot of money to other people as a modular device they could use when pre-screening all kinds of prospective joint venture candidates or distributors and the like. But the reason I'm sharing it is the same reason I'm doing the program. It's a philosophy of two things. One, the fact that in the course of any given year, I'll personally work with 10 or 20 clients. I'll impact maybe 2,000 people at my training programs. And there are 19 million small business owners around the country who are fighting the battle every day, who have allowed themselves to be satisfied with a fraction of the yield, a fraction of the reward, a fraction of the satisfaction, a fraction of the fulfillment, and a fraction of the control they could be entitled to, if by me sharing little inklings in what I do one-on-one with people who pay me $3,000 an hour or $25,000 for a big training program, I can help give them leverage on themselves, and they, in the process, can get more joy, more satisfaction, more fulfillment, and more impact for themselves, for their families, for their coworkers, and for ultimately the customers they touch. There's two theories in life. There's the scarcity and there's the abundance. It will come back. There'll be more success. There'll be more people who have the capacity to seek me out. There'll be more people who are making so much more money that they can comfortably engage me in my services. So I'll win ultimately, and I don't lose if I share it. And also, unfortunately, I know that most people don't do anything with the information, which is a tad indictment. It's why most people don't accomplish anywhere close to the capacity life has to give them. So my downside in sharing it's pretty low, Marty.
Okay, how about little guidelines to optimize the use of the information you're about to share? What can we do to not be those that fall off the wayside?
Well, what I think is every time you ever are pitted with a question or an insight or an impact in your life, you've got to make a commitment to the action coefficient that impacting realization necessitates you make. In other words, something happens and it makes a profound impact on you. The impact is useless if it dissipates. You got to make that impact your prisoner and take action on it. So the moment you have an impact, you got to stop, and as an extrapolator or an emulator or an importer or an interpreter, you got to say, what is the transactional application? What is the actual action I must take to make that impact, to make that revelation, to make that insight, to make that illumination a productive, a profitable, and a permanent benefit to my business and my personal life? And you got to write it down, then you got to decide to do it.
Okay. Okay, go ahead and tell us the background of this profile, just a little more where you're coming from on this.
Over the years, I have basically interacted with probably 5,000 or so people at my training programs. I've probably done, I don't know, 1,000 different one-hour, day-long consultations, and I have evaluated and examined hundreds of companies that I was considering getting involved in either a joint venture or an advisory or consulting relationship with. And I wanted to develop a process that would help me get a quick fix handle on what they were doing right, what they were doing wrong, what they weren't doing, what their potential or their improved, their leverage quotient really was. And I wanted to do it in a way that it wasn't just my own insights, but that I was able instantaneously to transfer to them a corresponding awareness so that it became clearly evident as we were talking or as we were getting to know each other, or as we were getting involved in a relationship, that they saw for themselves how much more they could get out of what they were doing. They saw for themselves critical questions and strategic issues that were of the utmost relevance to their life, their business, their success, but that they'd never really questioned or examined or asked themselves about.
Okay. You must have a whole area of psychology where you watch people who have capabilities you know, but they never execute.
And I do. It's very sad. I got to the point where I went through a process, Marty, where I used to worry. I wanted people's success more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I suffered what you would call empathy fatigue because I worried more about them and I couldn't. I mean, I just was always on the phone with people. And I went through a realization that I can't want someone's success more than they do.
Okay.
So I basically, my whole purpose is I've got, if you want this information, I will make it available. I will explain it. I will direct you. If you want to act on it, I will laud you. I will relish your success. I will celebrate for you. I will encourage you. I will not begrudge you a dime of your success, even if it's many times higher than me. If you don't act on it, I have no pity, no compassion, no desire or interest in being your social worker.
Okay. I had assumed that you had gone through that process at some point.
And you're right. I think it's important that people realize no one else can want your success more than you can. They can't want that success. You have to want it enough to commit to it. And it's not desire, it's decision. Because desire never gets you anywhere. Decision gets you everywhere. You decide you're going to do it. You decide you have to do it for and through yourself. You decide that your life will be richer for doing it than not. You decide that you no longer want to allow yourself to be content with a fraction of the yield, a fraction of the wealth, a fraction of the control that you're entitled to. And when you make that decision, and it's decisive, it's so different than desire, because desire doesn't really accomplish anything. Decision does.
I would guess you've seen a ton of desire.
Well, it is, but I tell you, I have a great advantage. I'm very good friends with a number of people who publish a lot of personal development, self-improvement, business development products. I have watched and looked. I've looked at their files, and I've looked at a lot of what they call their white mail. And their white mail are the positive letters they get from people.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the letters they get are from people who listen to their product, their tapes, or read their books and say, I'm so impressed, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Few of the letters are from people who've ever done anything, and I'm nonplussed by people who are going to do things. I am enormously impressed with people who do things.
Do you find in your life seminars, for example, that a lot of people want you to decide for them?
If I would let them, sure, they all want it done for them. But what I think is important is that you've got to decide for yourself. I am there as a tool. I am there as a catalyst. I am there as a coach But it's like one time I wanted to get a trainer, and I went to the gym, and I found a trainer, and I worked out for a day, and it was hard, and I never went back. And I always use that as a mental metaphor, that that's what most people are. They want to do something, but when they realize that it's not always fun and pleasurable in the beginning until you get your proficiency, they want to do something else, and they pass on. And I use myself as a hypocritical example of what not to do. I'm there for anybody who wants to come to the gym. I'm there for anyone who wants to be vigilant. I'm there for anyone who really wants to tone up their bodies this way, meaning their businesses, to become more stronger, more sinewy, more healthful, more joyous, and get much more out of life. If you don't want to come to the gym, hey, it's your body.
How about the after a person has decided, what is the next most likely area of blockage of execution?
Well, I think it's belief that they have the capacity to achieve or produce the kind of outcome that I represent. Most people really don't see themselves doubling or tripling their business or doubling or quadrupling their profits. Most people can't possibly envision not basically loathing what they do and not being a prisoner and shackled to it. Most people can't possibly imagine spending half the time and half the expense and producing three or four times the outcome. And even though they decide, they still aren't really confident. I think you got to believe, you got to see how easy it is to achieve.
Okay, so it goes back to kind of your expectation, what you're really believing at the bottom line.
Well, I would say it more than expectation. I'd say certainty that it's possible and easy. And I pretty well accomplished overcoming that by helping people realize what I'll call the laws of the quantum leap principle, or the laws of exponential growth. And that is that it's so much easier to improve a little bit a lot of areas that you're not taking advantage of, because combined that gives you massive lift. And I think on the tape we sent people, that was an interview I did with Anthony Robbins, I went through a little bit of the theory of exponentiality, where I showed people that if you just increased the three areas that your business growth and success is based on by a mere 10% in each area, the aggregate result is not 10%, it's 33%. If you increase each area by 20 or 25%, the aggregate is more like 200%. It just keeps going exponential, and you keep getting quantum leaps.
Okay. All right.
So when people see that on paper, they realize it's so much easier to get a massive improvement, so then they feel entitled and deserving, and they see it within grasp, but they see it as real, and then they're more motivated to do things. First thing I want to know is I want people to tell me how their product or service differs from the competition, either in construction, in result, in application, in pricing, in the way you render it, in the way you get it, in what it's designed to do, and what it's, how long it's designed to do it. I want to know what differentiation, if any, there is about your product, because if there is any, most people don't communicate it. If there isn't any, we've got to find something that we can differentiate about you or about it, whether we use preemption or whether we add something to it. But I want people to answer that and know it, because most people never ask themselves that question. Then I want to know what their vision is for their business in the next 6 months, year, 3 to 5 years, and 10 years, broken down not just in abstraction, but what they want the picture to look like, how many sales they want, where the customers are going to come from, what kind of customers they're going to be, what kind of products they're going to buy, what kind of products they'll buy subsequently, what number of transactions they see them doing. So they have a clear vision on where they're trying to get, so I can help them engineer backwards the strategy to get them there. I want them to answer what their biggest opportunity is to achieve that vision, because I want them to recognize what vehicle, what avenue, what mechanism, what route, what road, what path is the clearest, most immediate, and leveraged way to get there. I want them to verbalize what their biggest marketing or business problem is right now, not in abstraction, but as defined and dimensionalized and supported and analyzed as they've ever done it. Because most people just know that they're frustrated or struggling. They've never really grappled deeply with who the demon issue is, and they've never defined it, because normally when they define it, it's not as big a deal as they think.
Really?
Yeah. It's more onerous. It's more abstract. I mean, abstraction is always intimidating. Remember they said you have nothing to fear but fear itself?
Uh-huh.
When you dissect it and you break it down to its lowest common denominator, most of the things we're terribly fearful of either don't happen, are much less severe when they happen, can be averted totally or almost can have a productive side to it, but we've never really reckoned with that or really defined it or confronted it and really delved into it in a deep, dimensionalized manner.
As you have used this in live seminars, is it pretty surprising when people see it?
Well, I don't let people come until they've spent about 10 hours answering these questions.
Oh.
And by that time, they've reprogrammed their whole thinking. They've gotten much more tangible. They've gotten much more grounded. They've gotten much more possibility oriented. And hopefully they'll do this, as much of this as I can do today will work here.
Turn the tape over now for more of the program on Side 2.
I want them to have a handle on how much volume they do every month, how much sales, how much profit, what it averages per customer, so they have handles on what I'll call the life worth and the marginal net worth dynamics of their customer, because you can't really know what you can afford to do. You can't really know what a customer is worth to you. You can't know what you can afford to invest or spend on advertising, on sales acquisition allocation, on commission, until and unless you know what a customer is worth to you in initial sales, in subsequent sales, in profit. And most people never looked at that. I want them to know whether they really want more sales or more profit per sale. I want them to know what their real goal is. I want them to have a justification, because if they don't know, they can misdirect almost all their actions and activities and efforts and time.
Okay.
I want them to look at what they're getting revenue per employee or per staff member right now, so they have a basis of correlation. I want them to know if that's above or below their industry average. I want them to question things that they've never questioned. In other words, I want to know how well they're doing, because just by improving, if you know that the average industry is getting $500,000 worth of sales per year per customer and you're getting $200,000, well, that underscores something. You can look to your industry and say, what are they doing I'm not? How can I incorporate what they're doing in my business? And that alone can give you a lot of leverage.
If you were ahead on that paradigm, what would that be useful for?
Well, it could be useful for two things. Number one, incorporating teaching other people outside of your direct and competitive business what you do, because you probably have a technique or a mechanism or process that hundreds or thousands of other people within your direct industry, non-competitive areas, and outside of it would pay a handsome ongoing usage or percentage or training fee to learn, because it would give them greater leverage in their life. In other words, if I knew that I could make 8 hours produce 40 times more or 40% more yield than it currently does, and that's what it does for me, but it doesn't do it for you, and I could teach you how to do it, would you be willing to pay me to learn it?
Certainly.
But you got to recognize what you do well and what you don't. If you do it better than anyone else, you can teach other people. If you do it worse than anyone else, you got to see what other people do better and identify it and incorporate it. That makes sense?
All right, makes a lot of
sense.
That
simple little realization can be worth 30, 40, 50% greater results, response, profitability, closures. You got to question that stuff.
Okay.
You got to realize whether you consider your business to be large or small relative to your industry. How do you see your business, and how do you see what you want for your business? Until you know what your vision is, you can't really accomplish it. Most of the people I talk to remind me of people on a trip, and they're at one or two junctures. They either know where they are, but they don't know where they're trying to get to, so I can't help them and they can't help themselves. Or they know exactly where they're trying to get to, but they have no idea where they are, so they don't know what direction to take. You got to know both pieces of the trajectory puzzle, where you are now and where you're trying to get, so you know how to get there.
Okay.
I want to know who your target market is as definitively and precisely and measurably and dimensionally defined as you possibly can. I don't want to know that they're adults over 65. I want to know that they tend to be business owners making over $60,000 a year, who live in the utmost of neighborhoods, who drive the highest cars, who are members of country clubs, who play tennis, who own swimming pools. So I can find ways I can identify them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I want to know if you market locally, regionally, nationally, or internationally, because the strategies we will incorporate for you and you will incorporate for yourself differ dramatically. By the way, it's easier to be national than local. Get much more leverage because it's easy to find vehicles that reach a target audience nationally. It's a lot easier than if it's a vertical business you're in than it is to find a vehicle that reaches you on a local basis.
Does that have implications for someone thinking about starting a business?
Yeah, many businesses, particularly if you don't need facilities. If you need facilities, it makes it more troublesome. If you don't need localized facilities, we can make you nationally easier than we can make you successful locally, because we can use national media, national lists, national publications. We can do things with host beneficiaries on a national basis with far more leverage than we can locally. So, yeah, I would encourage everybody, if you can do it from a fixed point, to consider being national or even international, because it's more profitable and it's more leverageable.
Any ideas on selecting a business that can go national?
The kind of businesses that I recommend to people if I were going to start a business from scratch are ones that have high degrees of repeat factors to it, tend to be service-based, tend to be something that can be proprietary, tend to have high margins so you can afford to spend a lot of money on the acquisition of a customer, or you can build a lot into the program by adding different products or services to make your rendering of that service proprietary and not a commodity. And once you get a customer, you know you have a high probability that customer will keep coming back many times a year for many years to come.
Can you give me five examples?
Well, I mean, if I were going to be in a business, I'd want to be in a business that was constantly replenishable. I'd want to be in a service business like it's not the right thing, a pest control business, because you know every year at certain key times they're going to keep coming back and you can sign people up for perpetual programs, or tree cutting because they keep regrowing, or servicing automobiles. If you program people proactively, it's going to constantly be in need of service. Or if you buy software is that constantly get updated, so you can constantly be selling them the newer version forever and providing them with specific instruction and support because they bring new people in to train it, things like that.
All right, go ahead with the rest of the profile.
I want to know who your target market is. I told you that. And I want to know how do you go about targeting that market. I want to know what your primary methods of identifying and communicating and accessing that market currently are. In other words, the diving board theory. What your current most significant form of communication to that market is. I want to know what your unique selling proposition is, even if it's a weak one, and how you denominate, communicate, and personify it. I want to know how you arrived at that, the methodology or the awareness that got you to believe that was your unique selling advantage. Most people, when I ask them what USP is, they'll say service, dependability, or quality, which means nothing in the minds of the public. But to you, it might mean a lot. But until you've got a torque converter that translates in highly defined, illustrative analogies to people what service means, what satisfaction means, what quality means, and not just abstract words, but in demonstration, in results, in construction, it means nothing to people. I want to know if your USP is consistent in all your marketing and communication. In other words, if you purport to have this incredible quality, but when you have problems, that positioning isn't maintained by your customer service people or by your billing people or by your field repair people, then you've breached the whole benefit of an integrated USP. I want to know who your biggest competitors are, if any, what they offer that you don't, how they communicate it that you don't, what means of marketing they use that you don't, what means of marketing they use that you do, but that they use more dimensionally and more expansively, and how exactly they use them. I want to know what steps you take currently to offset the advantages that those other people may have over you, and what steps have you taken in the past. I want to know what your competitor's biggest weakness or failing might be. I want to know how you specifically fill or compensate for that failing in the way you conduct your business. I want to know completely but briefly what your marketing program and the marketing mix of actions and vehicles and pipelines you use to generate and sustain and regenerate business are, if you in fact have such in place and they're formalized, proactive, and strategic. I want to know if you currently use direct response marketing, and if so, which ones you use, direct mail, telemarketing, direct response, space ads, radio, television. I want to know how much of your time every month you devote to marketing and how you utilize that time. I want to know if you have a director or someone who's designated as full-time or as primary marketing operative in the business. I want to know what their responsibilities and duties entail and how they execute it. I want to know if you test ads, if you test premises, if you test headlines, if you test propositions, if you test guarantees, and if so, what your tests have revealed and what response or action or improvements or opportunities have resulted from that you've incorporated into your revised ongoing marketing mix. I want to know what your market potential is, realistically, what the universe is, the number of prospects, what the buying capacity is, what the repeat capacity is, so we can determine whether your vision for yourself is realistic or whether it's a pipe dream. I want to know what the ways are you have attained your customers in the past, rank value from best to worst. In other words, if referral is best, I want it number one. I want you to define what exactly and transactionally referral means to you. If newspaper advertising is the worst. I want you to define how you do it and what you do, and that is the worst. So I can get a picture, and you can get a picture, because a lot of times people will see that newspaper pulls less customers than referral, but they'll spend 90% of their time, money, and budget on newspapers, and I'll ask them what's wrong with this picture.
Okay.
Pretty interesting things, isn't it, Marty?
Yes.
I want to know what the average sales and profit of a new customer is in the first year. This, again, trying to evolve your your lifetime value. I want to know what the biggest and best source of new business has been and could be for you, and why. So I can make sure that your mind is really logical in its understanding.
Okay.
I want to know if you're really doing everything possible to secure business, and it's highly improbable that you can. One time I went to a training program conducted by a friend of mine, Anthony Robbins, and people were lamenting all the things they had not been able to accomplish in their life, with their marriage, with their business. And they'd say, I tried everything, Tony. And he'd look at him and he'd say, everything? And they'd say, yes, everything. He'd say, okay, tell me the last 100 things you tried in this area. And they'd look at him and say, well, I didn't do 100 things. He'd say, okay, tell me the last 50 things you tried. They'd say, well, I didn't do 50. He'd say, tell me the last dozen. They'd say, well, I didn't do dozen. They said, how many things did you do? And they'd say, one. So I'm trying to really get a handle for people. I want to know what their biggest marketing success has been to date and whether they continued it. Because most people find something successful and then they stop doing it. And if they don't, why not? If they do, how it's doing. I want to know their biggest marketing problem or challenge is today as clearly and definitively defined as possible. If they had all the money in the world and they could spend it any way they want, I want to know what they would do to improve their product or their success or their company, where they would spend it, what actions, what activities, what people, what human capital, what technology, what selling systems. I want to know what they do with it and why. I want to get programmed into how they think. I want to know if they have a written marketing plan that they refer to and they can gauge and they can measure and they can compare and they can correlate on a constant basis to see whether they're in line and whether that plan gets them definitively and specifically and transactionally to the outcome they're seeking, whether they even know what the outcome is. I wonder if they have the capacity to handle a sudden increase in business or even a long-term increase in business. And if they don't, what changes have to occur both financially, both transactionally, both organizationally, both structurally, and whether they have the wherewithal financially to manage it, managerially to manage it, compositionally, just in their emotional capacity. I want to know what their customers really want and whether they even know, and if they say they know, how they know and what they've done. I want to know why people buy from them instead of their competitors. I want to know what problem their product or service solves for the customer and what the benefit and result of that solution occurring is in as measurable a manner as possible. I want to know what the biggest customer complaint about their industry is and figure out how we can use that to a selling advantage. I want to know if your company, I want to know what the company currently does to combat that complaint or what they could be doing, how much more. I want to know what their business philosophy is in relationship to their customers. I have uttered and shared with you, Marty, a philosophy of falling in love with the customers. I've uttered to you a positioning of subordinating yourself and being dedicated to bringing greater benefit, greater advantage, greater value to the customers. I mean, that's mine. That's what I want to teach if you want to embrace it, but I want to know what your current philosophy is. I wonder if they have an adequate supply of customer testimonials and success stories that are very measurable. If they don't, I want to know if they can get them, and I want to know if they're written, if they're audio, if they're videotaped. I want to know how they would use those and how they could use them in their marketing for proof, for social proof, for references. I want to know if they have a system in place for soliciting and capturing testimonials and soliciting and developing referrals on an ongoing profit center basis. If so, I want to know what it is. If not, I want to know why. I want to put one in. I want to know how they capture and preserve the names of their customers, prospects, key buying influences, and whether they've got key target prospect lists. I want to know what their selling seasons might be for different products or services and why and how they maximize and optimize them and if they do. I want to know if they're actively looking to sell other products during the slow periods and how they can optimize and maximize the customer base, the organization, the distributive networks they've got, even if their business drops, how they can utilize the system they've put in place and the assets they have created and invested in more productively. I want to know how they tell customers to contact them in between, how they program methodically and systematically their customers to ongoing to do ongoing business with them. I want to know if they employ telemarketing, either as a pre-post selling device, as a separate profit center, as a mechanism for lead generation, as a mechanism to support their field sales people, as a mechanism to develop territories long long distance that they can't justify dispatching a salesperson to as a means of managing lesser profit clients. And I want to know if they do any of that, how they do it, and if they don't, why they don't, and if they don't, if they could. I want to know how well it works. I want to know how loyal their customers, and I want to know if that loyalty is above or below the industry and why that loyalty does or doesn't exist. I want to know all the ways we could improve it for them. I want to know if they have a system for generating constant referrals. I want to know if their customers and prospects are direct responsive, and if they've never found out, how we can find out and test it right away to determine the level of improvement. I want the brief description of the niche they fill or they could fill in their industry. And I want the niche that they fill in their customers' mind, because their customers may see them totally different than they see themselves. I want to know if they run space advertising, if it's working, and what working means to them, and how they know, how they measure, and what they compare it against. I want to know if their advertising is direct response or imaging, and if it's direct response, I want to know why and how and what kind of responses they find acceptable and what they've experimented and tested. I want to know their philosophy on advertising in general and on the construction of an ad and what they see their ad's purpose and job as being. I want to know who creates their advertising, in-house or outside, and who the key person is doing it, and what their background, their basis, and their philosophy is. I want to know how much advertising they do a month and how those ads produce. I want to know what their budget is and how they evolved it. I want to know what the return on investment is and what their allowable cost per customer is. I want to know if they understand and use two-step and three-step multi-stage selling and multi-influence selling. I want to know how much they spend to bring in a lead and how many leads convert to customers if they use such a device. I want to know what their conversion ratio is. And in lead generating, there are four key ingredients. Number one is the acquisition cost, what it costs you to bring a lead in. Number two is the number of leads that convert to customers. Number three is the average unit of sale those leads convert to initially. Number four is the residual value of those customers. Until you know what they do in all four of those gradients, you can't justify whether a lead that costs you $50 to acquire is cheap or expensive, and whether one that costs you 50 cents is cheap or expensive, because you need to know all the answers to those questions. I want to know what they spend currently to bring in a lead and whether that's enough or too much. I want to know what the advertising cost per sale is. I want to know if they do multi-step selling. In other words, if people don't buy on the spot, if they have a conversion kit or a follow-up kit or a lead generating kit that is used to convert leads to sales, and it's basically a mechanized embodiment of the greatest sales positioning and case you can extol, written and audio or video or whatever. I want to know if they test all the things they test, copy, offer, price, media, list, guarantees, etc. If they do direct mail, I want to know how much prospecting they do every month. I want to know where they get their list, why they get them, what the return on investment is running, and whether that's acceptable or not. I want to know how that return can be improved. I want to know if they create their own and what the basis of creation is. I want to know about their back end. This is all important, the residual implications of their business. If they have a back end, I want to know what it is. I want it defined. I want to know how well it works. I want to know what they do to cultivate it and to program it on a strategic manner. I want to know the life value of a customer, how much revenue he or she will generate over the entire buying period or selling period that they do business with you. I want to know if they have their customer list on computer and how many different ways they can segment it by buying knowledge, by areas of purchase, by dollar purchase, by frequency of purchase, by sophistication of purchase. I want to know how often they mail their customer list and why they've evolved to that frequency. A lot of people mail only once a year, but even though they can mail once a month, and it'd be profitable, and they have no reason for doing it.
That one idea might make somebody a ton of money.
Well, normally when people go through this question and answer process, it makes them thousands of dollars. If people just listen to these questions and ask them themselves, if they don't make many times their subscription investment in the Wizard's Edge, I'll be very surprised, Marty.
Okay, go ahead.
I wonder what their average return on order is. If they've never asked themselves these questions, it's imperative they do. What are the steps you can take to increase the average order? I want to know if theirs is a repeat business. If it isn't, what other products or services will their customers most logically buy? I want to know if they actively solicit referral business and exactly what the process they use is. I want to know how often a typical customer buys from them and what the implication of those purchases are to that customer's life or business. I want to know if they've ever tried to reactivate old customers or reactivate unconverted prospects. I want to know what else they do with the customers, joint venture, renting them out to their competitors or to kindred people, and what the implications might be, or the impact, or the revenue, or the profit contributions. I want to know what ways they try to upsell or cross-sell customers at or right after the point of sale. I want to know when the last time they introduced a new product or service to the market was, how they did it, and what the result was, and how many more new products or services they might be able to introduce, whether their products is they create or whether their products other people do. I want to know if they make consistent efforts to educate their customers about what their company is doing to help them, what the results are, and if so, how they do it. If not, why they don't. After the initial sale, I want to know how much communication they have with their customers and what exactly they do, whether it's a strategic plan in place or whether it's ad hoc and very free form and very unsophisticated and ineffectual. I want to know what they do at the point of sale to increase the order or add on to the products or position people for future purchases. I want to know how often and in what way they communicate with their customers and they connect with their customers and they build the loyalty and the affinity and the predisposition. I want to know how many ways they've segmented their market. I want to know if they have a sales force, and if so, how many people, and if so, what they know about it, what the baseline knowledge, how many prospects the people call on, how many customers they're assigned, how much each person sells, what the unit of sale is, what the average of each person is, what the variances are, what certain people's selling skills are, so I can see different attributes we can teach to others. It's, a lot of times, if you have 10 salespeople, one may do something 10 times better than the other, and if you can identify how they do it and teach it to the other may not do it 10 times better, but they might do it 5, and it's instant leverage. I want to know what the incentives are, the inducements you give your salespeople, and why you evolved and how they work, and what better inducements, variable or bonus or distinction-wise, you can create that will produce greater results from the sales force. I wonder if they use independent sales reps or if they could. I want to know if they work through dealers, and if so, how in the process, and what communication. I wonder if they have a sales manager or somebody who takes the job equivalent, and they want to know how they dispatch their duties. I wonder what the gross and net income per salesperson is. I wonder how that compares to the industry. What methods we could employ to improve on the selling, what the selling philosophy is, what the selling presentation is, what the most effective and successful sales approach they've used and they are using is. I want to know how much time they personally devote, the owner, to selling and to communicating with customers every month, if any, and I want to know what they do and what they get out of it and what action they take after doing it. I wonder if they're consistently reaching their monthly and quarterly sales goals or whether they even have goals to reach. I want to know how much professional training they give themselves, their salespeople, and all their other staff members, including their receptionist and their customer service, because that singularly is the biggest instantaneous leverage you can give yourself is to learn professional selling. More strategic selling than technical, because it's two different philosophies. Most people learn technical selling only, and those techniques are not the key. Changing the strategy is what gives you more leverage. I wonder if their customer service and sales department is prompt, courteous, and value-oriented.
Can you amplify that strategy versus technical skills selling?
Yeah, sure. Most people who sell try to sell on technique, not on philosophy. If you change the philosophy, and you'll remember on one of these sessions we did this concept of preeminence.
Right.
That preeminence was a total change in philosophy to bringing the greatest result, the greatest education, the greatest advice, the greatest protection, the greatest improvement in the life or the business of the customer. And that's a different strategy than most people, which is just how can I sell my product? Or, what can I say to make my product exciting instead of what can I do to make the customer more benefited? When you change the strategy, it's normally many times more effective than just changing the selling techniques. Strategy is what gives you more leverage in life. If you look at the greatest successes in history, you'll see in business, in religion, in arts, in industry, in sports, in military, it normally occurred when somebody who probably didn't have any more, maybe even had less attributes, less manpower, less capital, less skill, less ability, but they had a better strategy than the people they were vying against.
Okay.
Strategy is singularly the most critical change you can make in the way you do something to produce a massive improvement, much more so than technique.
Okay. All right. Go on with the profiling.
Okay. I want to know if they ever shop their customers and whether they ever shop their own business. In other words, until you walk in the shoes of your customer or the shoes of your competitor's customer, you don't really know what reality is. And unless you shop figuratively and literally your customers, your competitors, unless you shop yourself and do it as a customer and see how you're treated and see what people do or don't do, see what your competitors do, you don't have a perspective of improvement or self-evaluation. I want to know what type of ongoing training you currently offer your salespeople and your other staff and what it's based on and how it works and what the frequency is. I want to know if your customer service department is prompt and courteous. I don't know how long it takes for you to produce a sale and fulfill on a sale. In other words, is it quick? Is it easy? Is it hard? Does it take many segments of transaction? When you have a sale, is it hard for it to be delivered? Is it something they walk away with? I want to know if buyer's remorse is a problem, how you overcome it. One of the most successful strategies you can incorporate is called post-purchase dissonance compensation. It's to overcome buyer remorse. I want to know if you do joint ventures, and if so, with whom? If not, who could you do them with? I want to know what other unusual selling or marketing or recruiting or production tactics or methods you've tried that have worked, and what the results were, and why and how you did them, and why and how you continue doing them, and whether you stopped doing them and why. I want to know if you've created any proprietary concepts, ads, mailing pieces, products, services in the past, and you've ever licensed or sold them to other businesses, or whether you could. I wonder if you ever tried to sell any of the processes that are paramount to your success, or that you do better than other people in your industry or outside. I wonder if your vendors have a direct financial interest in your growth, your success, and your operation, and whether you get them to invest financially and support-wise in you being able to do more of what you do, whether they fund, whether they cooperate, whether they are vested and committed to helping you grow your business, or whether they just basically are parasitical. I wonder if you ever tried contingent or per inquiry or per order type variable compensated advertising, where you can only pay people for results instead of advertising. I wonder if you use public relations, and if so, what your strategy is, and what kind of positioning you use, and what kind of stories you disseminate. I want to know if you've ever tried to sell your non-converted prospects and competitors to competitors, and whether you've joint ventured, and what the outcome has been, or whether you could. I want to know if you ever barter anything, and if so, how you do it, and why. If you don't, why not? Because bartering is the greatest profit center most companies can create, and there's about 21 ways you can use it, or one of the programs we'll talk about it, Marty. I want to know if your business got into a bind, cash flow, slumping sales, low utilization of employees. What strategies would you most logically use to get out of it, or are you using right now? I want to know if you use bonus inducements in your selling promotions and packages to get people more value. I want to know what kind of risk reversals you're currently using and what kind you could use. And I want to know if you were to add something that would make it a better than risk reversal, what that would be. I want to know what kind of guarantees or warranties you currently give your customers. I want to know if you buy from your competitors and track how they follow up to see what they do after selling over the long haul to ingratiate and sustain business as opposed to what you do. I want to know what incentives you've got and bonuses you've got to reward and enrich your employees for creating new and better marketing methods, innovations, or customer value-generating processes. I want to know if you actively seek information from experts in your field and other experts outside and what you do with.
Okay, a lot of material there. It sounds to me like if a person were to discipline himself or herself to sit down and write that out, it would change their lives.
It normally produces a massive improvement just by going through and questioning and taking action in all these areas.
Okay, in roughly 10 minutes, how about if I wanted you to produce instant results, do you have 10 ideas you could share to do that?
Sure. I'll give you 10 ideas in 10 minutes. The first one is start using a greater rationale. Whenever you want someone to do something, a prospective customer, an existing customer to buy more or more often, a prospective customer to buy, or an employee to do more or address a new project, give them a rationale. Give them the reason why. There was a wonderful test that a famous psychologist did of trying to see what would happen when there was a bunch of people at a Xerox in a business, and he wanted to break into the front of the line. When he tried to just break in, without giving people a reason why, almost nobody let him. When he broke in and gave them a reason why, almost everyone let him, and half people offered to do the job for him. Give people the reason why, the method of your madness, the rationale.
Idea number two.
Okay. You know, you've got an incredible gold mine in your old relationships. Use your relationships and the endorsability you have with it to introduce your customers, old or active, even your prospective customers who never bought, to new products and services either you can sell or that you know about because they are eager to buy. Sometimes people sell all of the product or services they offer to a customer, and the customer has no capacity to buy anything else from them, but the customer has a great respect and affinity with them, and if they would just lead the customer by introducing them to new products or services, that customer would eagerly buy those from them.
Okay. Number three.
Don't be afraid in the first transaction you have to automatically position the customer for future sale by giving them an incentive
for what I'll call a TFN purchase. If you know you sell a product or service they could easily avail themselves of on an ongoing basis, get them to commit right now to what we call a TFN arrangement, that until further notice, TFN, you will automatically either deliver to them or hold for them or send to them or make available to them a finite supply of your product or service every blank, every week, every month, every quarter, and automatically either send them an invoice or bill their charge card or deduct from their checking account until they stop getting value or stop needing it or tell you to stop. That will normally increase the revenue per customer by about double.
Okay. All right, number four.
Always look for what the back end is. Everybody's got at least one or two or three more back ends in their business, residual sales, other products or services, repeats, they could avail themselves of, and most people don't use it.
Number five.
Always upsell. There was a recent study that said, in every selling situation, if you but offer the customer at the point of sale, after they made the decision to buy, after they're excited, the chance to buy a larger unit or add a couple of other products or services to the unit or extend the purchase frequency, 40% to 60% on average will avail themselves just by being offered it. But if you don't offer it, you're leaving 40 to 60% more sales and probably double the profits on the table just by not doing it.
Number six.
Look to your vendors. Who within your vendors, the people who supply you or support you, has more to gain by you being even more successful than you do? And it may not be an existing vendor. Maybe somebody who wants to be a vendor. And go to them and ask them to invest in your success. Ask them to invest either by funding or co-funding direct mailings or by funding or co-funding advertisements or by funding or co-funding different salespeople you might bring on, because they have more to gain, relatively speaking, by you growing than even you do. Make them contribute to your success.